Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and it is The Stacks Book Club Day, and it's National Poetry Month, so we're talking about Jericho Brown's Pulitzer Prize-winning poetry collection, The Tradition, with poet, lawyer, and activist Reginald Dwayne Betts. If you don't know who Reginald Dwayne Betts is, he was our guest the first week of April, and I suggest you go back and listen. He is also the founder of the Million Book Project, which is the organization that we're attempting to raise $50,000 for this month. Million Book Project brings new books into prisons to counteract what prison does to the human spirit. And we are well on our way to hitting our goal, and I'm just asking you to click the link in the show notes to donate what you can, because every human deserves access to books. And as a reminder, Million Book Project is run through Yale's Law School. So when you do click that link, you'll be redirected to a Yale donation page. Don't worry, you're in the right place. And thank you, thank you, thank you for contributing to this organization. The Stacks Book Club pick for May is Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy. We'll be discussing the book on the podcast on Wednesday, May 26th. And if you haven't started yet, don't worry. If you start today, you only have to read 28 pages a day to finish in time for the episode. You can do it. I want to say thank you to the Stacks Pack, the people who contribute to this podcast monthly over on Patreon. Without you all, there would be no podcast. If you'd like to help support me and the work of the show and earn perks like discounts on merch and access to our virtual book club, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join. This week, I'm saying thank you to some of our newest members, Laura Galler, Kara Babkich, Dog Mom Bookworm, Emily, Melissa Allam, Corey Thomas, Reading with Glamour, Haley Johnston, Rachel Rogers, and Smile, It's Joy. Thank you so much for your support. I could not do it without you all. And now it's time to talk poetry with Reginald Dwayne Betts by way of Jericho Brown's The Tradition. All right, everybody, welcome back to The Stacks. I am here today again with Reginald Dwayne Betts, who from here on out I will call Dwayne because that's the name he likes to be called. And if you haven't listened to his first episode, you would know that only people he doesn't like call him Reginald. Hi, true. How are you? Welcome back.
It is my pleasure. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm so excited. So it is the last week of National Poetry Month as of this airing, and you graciously, as a poet and a memoirist and an activist and a lawyer and all these things, you graciously agreed to come on the podcast and talk to me, a heathen, about poetry. And I am terrified of this conversation because I don't want to sound stupid, but I also feel like maybe I understood some of the poetry. So we'll see how I did. But for those of you listening, we're going to discuss Jericho Brown's Pulitzer Prize winning poetry collection called The Tradition. And Dwayne is going to help us sort of, those of us who are nervous about poetry, talk about it. And also those of you who love poetry, talk about it, because this collection is very good. And I felt like it was accessible for me. I didn't feel as stupid as I thought I was going to when I heard the words Pulitzer Prize and poetry put together. So where we always start, Dwayne, with these conversations is just sort of generally, what did you think of the book?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been reading Jericho's poetry for a minute, and so I'm a fan. And so I think the question, I always feel biased asking the question because I knew I would dig the book before I even read it. But I think, though, what I will say is it is hard to go back to America again and again and make verse out of it. And it is hard to do it in a way that feels capacious and not reductive. And he does it, you know. Mm-hmm. And also, I will say that as far as poets go, it is hard not to be overwhelmed by your obsessions. Mm-hmm. And he writes not just about, we all have multitudinous obsessions, but we have publicly recognizable obsessions. So for me, my obsession is obviously prison. Mm-hmm. And that is what the public recognizes. And so Jericho's obsession is sexuality and gender. And yet he does a really impressive job of always pushing out beyond that in a way in which you recognize that maybe his real obsession is blackness. And, mm-hmm. and that blackness is capacious enough to hold questions of gender, of sexuality, of violence, of history, of fatherhood. And I really do think, I mean, this book came out the same year my book came out. And so in a way, it was one of those situations where I was constantly asking myself how I feel about the success of my peers. Mm. And he was one of those cats that was like doing really well. And I was happy to know that I really did feel like he earned his shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you don't always feel that way. You sometimes you feel like judge is fucked up.
Yeah.
But I felt like he earned all the praise he got.
I want to ask you about obsessions because I'm very fascinated about this. Because I think it's like, it's not just what you, the artist, obsess over, but it's also what the public obsesses over about you. The people decide about you
that's
that true. That's like where you're pigeonholed or whatever, I think is another way of saying it. I'm curious just for you, if you weren't writing about prison, if you could write about one of your other obsessions, one of the other things that you are passionate about, what do you think you would like to write about?
So if I had a project and I was like, all right, I'm going to write a series of poems about this thing. Often this comes out in essays, but I just had this question frequently. I'll write a bunch of poems about basketball.
Mm.
And then I've recently been writing a lot of poems about flowers, though.
Hmm.
It's you know, strange, man, that these names of flowers are like radically wild. You know, it's beautiful in a way. You got these Latinate names that feel ridiculous, but then you had these names that are trying to really get at the world, and you're like, oh shit, that is like sort of beauty there, right? So, for instance, you know, the orange daylily. I got a tree in my yard. It's a saucer magnolia. And it's beautiful. It's pink. And just to think about what it looks like, I got these, I think, daffodils or tulips, and they're called Narcissus Poet. You know what I mean? Mm. It's like, this is my flower right here. it's called the Poet's Narcissus, you know? And it's a daffodil. And I didn't know that. And so what happens is I'm taking pictures of these things and I'm thinking of ideas based on the flowers. I would write about flowers, but then I would use the flowers. The flowers will come a way for me to write about something else, though. And it might return in prison because automatically now I'm thinking, you know, where I didn't see anything bloom is in the dirt, in the prison dirt. Like,
right.
Like it's easy to grow stuff. Flowers are cheap and inexpensive and they return year after year. And there's no real reason for there not to be any flowers in prison, except there can't be anything beautiful in prison, except us when, you know, some nights were still beautiful. But I think, and I would write about my family more, you know, and I think what I wouldn't write about and what I wouldn't write for is the Americans who imagine my community must be responding to their existence, you know, and so that could be anything, you know. I'm from PG County. I would write something that was deeply and richly PG County. You know, in a way that don't give a fuck if you're from Detroit or New York or Texas or California. It's not trying to fit itself in your understanding of what it meant to be a black boy in 1986 in PG County, Maryland, in a place that felt like another kind of black belt where it was, you know, one white student all through elementary school and two Chinese kids all through elementary school and some other Southeast Asian kids that were so fucking ostracized that we didn't even have a name for who they were. They were just, we just called them their name.
Right.
They didn't have a culture or a history or a heritage, right?
Right.
I would write about what it meant to try to be a good kid in that space and what it means to be an adult reflecting on how easy it was not to see others, you know, even while bemoaning how, like, we weren't seen. I don't know, man.
I like that. Okay, let's talk about the collection. Sorry, I just, you know, I get curious about things. I just want to talk about them. So my first question, and this is actually something that you and I have talked about via email in January, and I'd love to just hear you talk about it for other people because it's something that really made me stop and think, which is poetry fiction or nonfiction? And what does that mean or say about poetry, or why does that matter, or why is that important to even classify it, or is it? And just go ahead.
That's interesting, because I think some of the poems resist that kind of classification. And if you slow down and hear the poem, you realize that poetry is existing in some liminal space between fiction and nonfiction.
Hmm.
And so for me, what that means is poetry is versatile. Poets are chameleons. sometimes they can't help but to write out of their own experience. Sometimes something hits them and strikes them so deeply and passionately that they need to render it in verse. And it might be a blow-for-blow recitation of something that happened to them. But I think the power of poetry, particularly for somebody like me who also writes memoir, is I get to get outside of myself like the fiction writer. I get to embody characters. I get to embody ideas. I get to feel better than I am or worse than I am on a page. And I get to do it in a way that's not tied down to facts. And so I think poetry just is. Mm. You know, I think poetry just is. Because what happens is, I was listening to DMX. It fucked me up that DMX died. And it ain't fucking me up. Like, I ain't one of them niggas who be like, this celebrity died or this musician died, and it hit me because, you know, because their music meant so much to me, whatever. I'm just not one of those people, right?
Mm-hmm. Me neither.
But what hit me when DMX died is like in 98 when he had them two albums that dropped, I was entering prison. And I missed his singles and everything because I was in prison. So like his music was the first indication for me that shit was still going on in the world that I was missing out on. Because you get sent to the jail and you don't got access to a radio and you can't really listen to the radio station. And then you get sent to juvie and you can't listen to the radio. And then you get sent to like the prison and you at receiving and you don't have access to the radio. And then you on a compound and people listen to music because they had access to the radio. And you like, wait, the world was still going? You know, I realized I had missed 2 years. But then going back to his music, I'm like, some of the grimiest things he said and some of the more painful things he said, I'm like, do they matter because they make me believe I know Earl Simmons? Do they matter because they make me believe I know DMX? I'm like, no. They matter because they hit me in some emotional space that makes me think differently about what it means to be human. You know, and I think that's fundamentally different from like you reading a memoir, because the memoir should do that same thing, but the memoir often has to make you respond to the person in a different way. So when you read Andre Agassi's Open, you like, fuck, I got a whole different kind of respect for Andre Agassi. You
right,
know?
Right, right.
And you shouldn't respect me because you read some poems I wrote. You know, you shouldn't love me because you read some poems I wrote. Because frankly, those poems don't necessarily give you deep insight into who Reginald Dwayne Betts is as a human being.
Right, because there's not an assumption, you know, that you're necessarily telling the truth with poetry either. Like with a memoir, right, there's an assumption that there is some form of truth to the author, at least. Maybe it's not fact checkable, but with poetry, it's like, this could just be something that this person created, or this could be something that's reflective, and there's no...
We misread poetry when we demand in our own head that it reflects something about the writer.
Right.
Because that's not why it matters. You know, like I feel like DMX doesn't matter because his work reflects something about him. Because I don't know him, can never know him. But I know what his music makes me feel and how it makes me think. And I think that's what Jericho book does. You know, I don't think we should read this and think we know him. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we should read it and think we have some insight into some of the ways his mind works. And because of that, we have added insight into how we might want to think about the world, given those considerations.
Right. Yeah, because I agree with that. When I read this book, I definitely was like, who is this person? Like, I didn't necessarily feel like I knew who Jericho was at all. And I went ahead and listened to him on some other podcasts, and I got a better sense for him. But I when I finished the collection, I was not like, oh, I know who this is. I actually had more questions about him and his life and was like trying to Google things and be like, what is happening?
And people might say, yo, but that is him. And I'd be like, yo, but I mean, me and Jericho friends, but I don't know his mama name. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I'm not like, and I'm telling you that I'm friends with a lot of people. And if they think they know me and they ain't seen me cry,
right,
then they bugging. Well, if they think they know me and I haven't revealed some deeply, you know, the people that you're really close to are few. And I think that as writers, what happens is because of if we're good, we tend to be vulnerable. Either if it's our vulnerability or the vulnerability that we invoke in the things that we write, people tend to think that that makes us more accessible as humans. Mm. But that's false. That's just people who don't know us believing that. You know, I want you to value the poems. I think of stuff in these poems just like, whoa, let me think again about how I thought about that thing that you're writing about. You know,
right.
And let me see where that takes me.
Do you feel like you can always tell what the person's writing about? That's where I struggle. Yeah. It's like sometimes I read a poem and I'm like, I don't know what we're even talking about. I feel like I get in these places where I'm like, okay, like what? You know, sometimes the title's like On Flowers and I'm like, great, we're talking about flowers. But sometimes it's like, you know, an adverb or something. And I'm like, I don't know what we're talking about. Like, I don't like.
So what we should do is think of both. Like in these poems, because, you know,
I mean, there's literally a poem in this collection called Flower. I wasn't making a dig at that poem, but there is one now. I'm like flipping through.
That's how poetry works. Because I was talking to you about flowers earlier. So yeah. I think what we should do is be like, okay, is it a poem in here that is like, I don't know what the hell it's about. And you'll challenge me and I might be like, yo, look, sometimes it ain't about nothing. Sometimes it's the yin yang twins.
Right.
You know, sometimes from the window to the wall. What is that? And ain't nobody been in a club rocking to it and been like, wait a minute. I actually don't understand what he's talking about. You know, so I think we got to give ourselves permission in poems to find pleasure in a lack of meaning if there is pleasure for us to find. And so that pleasure might come in addiction. It might come in words. It might come in sounds. Or we might just say, you know what? I think this poet actually means something that they aren't clearly communicating to me. Mm. And I'm going to put this one to the side and I'm going to rock with the ones that I think are trying to communicate something that I could grasp. Because sometimes you can't get it, you know? But right. But I think Jericho is one of those poets who he probably would say, if you don't get the thing that he's saying, he made some mistake. And we should talk about a few. Because I know a few that's like, damn, what is he talking about? What is he talking about? And then he like sort of pulls the rug under the carpet or whatever the hell that is, mm-hmm. you know, and it reveals itself only on the last line.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. So the way that, let me just tell you how I approach reading poetry and you tell me how wrong or right this is. Because you tell that I'm like a very black and white person, that I really like rules and regulations. And so I think that's part of my problem with poetry, I think, is that it's like I think I have to do too much work as the reader. I just want to be told all the information.
You know, what's messed up is like when I found out your podcast was called The Stacks, I was like, this shit is dope. And then when we were talking, you said how much you love nonfiction. I realized why I never connected The Stacks to like books.
Hmm.
Because The Stacks is really, really like smart people who like nonfiction. Like, I started thinking about The Stacks when I was in law school and I'm going into The Stacks, but I never associated it with like fiction. And what I love is you bring all of these writers on and it's cross-pollinating. And so now I'm telling people like I'm going to be like, yo, we building The Stacks in prison. That's what I'm going to call the Freedom Library. They're like, what is the piece? I'm like, oh, those are The Stacks. And you can't have a library without Stacks. And those are it's not a bookshelf. Those are The Stacks.
Right.
You know,
right. I love it.
How you approach it.
But so how I approach reading poetry is that if I like a poem, I'm like, great, I got it. I like it. And if I don't like it or I don't get it, I just move on. Like, I don't take any time to reevaluate. I just assume that that poem is not for me in that moment. You know what I mean? Oh. And sometimes like I'll be on the internet and like a poem will come up and I'll start reading it and I'm like, this does not grab me, and I'll just stop reading it. Like, I don't take time to really, unless I really like it. If I really like it, I might read through it like two or three times. Like, I was reading a poem by Nate Marshall last night and I was like, ooh, I really like this. And so I read it like five times and I was like, this is very good.
Shout out to Nate Marshall from Chicago. Yeah. We still supposed to rap about his book.
It's
we supposed to rap
really
about his
good.
Last book. Yeah. Let me ask you this. All right. So, personal question.
Okay.
Do you drink?
Not really, no.
Okay. So, that doesn't work for you. I drink, though.
Okay.
And I remember as a kid, like, drinking Mad Dog 2020.
I don't even know what that is. Is that like a beer?
It is horrible. It's like a wino drink.
Okay.
And so, it's basically like Kool-Aid, but with a lot of alcohol in it.
Got it.
And then I got out of prison. And the first drink I had was like Hennessy or something, but the regular Hennessy. And it like burned your throat. And mm-hmm. It ain't really good.
No.
And you drink it again and you're like, oh, I'm drinking to get drunk. But then you have something that's really great, but you got to get accustomed to it. Like this, mm-hmm. the smokiness of like, you know, scotch.
Sure.
The sort of peatiness of it. Or or like with the difference between something that's been aged for 10 years and something that's just fresh out of the barrel. And the point is that the flavors develop. And I think the same thing happens with ramen, and you got a 14-hour ramen soup, right? That they've been like letting the flavor steep for 14 hours versus when you make a pack of oodles and noodles.
Right.
Fuck me up when somebody was like, let's go have ramen. And I'm like, I'm never eating ramen again. Right. And then I go to this Japanese restaurant and it's like, delicious. This is not what we had in prison.
Right. But okay. So here, listen to this though. The reason I don't drink, and it's not because of any like holier than thou, I don't care. I like if a drink tastes good, like there's a margarita that I love in LA from a place called Petty Cash. It's my favorite drink ever. I will drink it. And I will drink plenty of it. I don't drink because I don't like the taste of alcohol, which is sort of what I'm saying about poetry.
Well, it's poetry,
like
right.
When I get to a poem that I don't like or I don't get, I just don't waste my time on it. If I go to a bar and I order a cocktail and it tastes gross, I will not finish it. I will not drink it. I do not like it. I will not order a cocktail from a place like I will not get a well drink. Like I won't just go get like vodka cranberry. Like, no, thank you. It has to be like a cocktail that sounds delicious. I won't drink anything up.
I'm kind of bougie. I don't suggest you get a well drink either. Although if you get it, you could get, but that's the thing. That's what you mix drinks for. You could get a Manhattan.
But I mean, like at the night, like I won't, if I go to a nightclub or something, which I don't do anymore, obviously I'm washed. But when I used to, I would never drink bottles. Like, you know, they bring you whatever. And like, I'm like, I don't want this with soda water. Like I want a cocktail with pieces of snacks in it. Like I want smoke on top. I want to be wowed by flavor. I want
that's
a rim.
Me. So, but I see this is how I messed up because the thing is like, I guess what I mean is with the poems, you got to be willing to develop a taste for some things. And I don't think though, it's the same thing. Alcohol, you take a sip. Oh, that's not good. And maybe another time you take a sip of a similar drink made by somebody else. I mean, that's what we do with poems. But the thing that we have to do with poems is like, I ask this though. I won't go back to a poem again if I didn't like it at all. Mm. But every time I read the poem, I'm like, is it one line in here that I'm really feeling? Mm. And then I might write that line down. It's just like, I look at it like, I think my comparison is when I listen to music. I frequently don't dig music the first time I hear it.
Same.
But it might be a hook that I like. It might be a beat. And the problem is like poetry lacks all of that accompaniment. So you got to be like, I said some shit once and somebody said it sounded cool. And I was like, damn, I'm going to say this shit all the time. And it was like, but alas, it's just two words. You know, I was like, but alas. Right. And in this long thing I had said, the person was like, yo, but when you say but alas, that shit sounded like, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to start saying that shit. And so now those two words end up in a lot of my poems or some poems. But for no other reason, and I started to like how they sounded because somebody else said it sounded dope. And my point is, when you listen to poetry, when you read poetry, the first thing is not like, do you get the whole poem? The first thing is it anything in this poem that gives you joy? Mm. And meaning and joy is two different things. I think that sometimes our literary and like sort of this is how it has to be brain forces us to imagine that joy and comprehension are equivalent. And right. I think joy and comprehension just frankly aren't equivalent. I got a puppy. I never understand what the fuck this puppy is doing. And I get an endless amount of joy from the puppy doing things, you know? And right. So I think that, and the poetry is brief enough that it gives us the opportunity to disconnect joy from comprehension.
But I find joy in understanding things. Like, one of the things that brings me so much joy is the aha moment, which is why if I get a poem, like if I'm like, oh, I know what they're talking about, or like, I can relate to this, that's when I enjoy it. Cause I'm like, oh, I get it. And I hear what you're saying that I need to not do that basically, but it's like, I don't like feeling like I don't get it. Like I don't like, cause even in poems that I like, I often don't get plenty of parts of them. Like, I'm like, wait, I don't know. But I hear what you're saying. Like, I might like a stanza, or like, I might like the way something rhymes. Like, for example, I don't know how to say the word, the guzzle.
Yeah, the guzzle.
Like, what I liked about that poem when I read it in your book is I liked that it had that rhyme structure. And so that right. was my way in. And then I could read it and be like, oh, I get this. Also, it's a pretty like straightforward poem in the fact that I understood what you were talking about pretty much right off the bat. But
every one of those couplets, this is like the quintessential non-linear, non-narrative poem. Because I say like, name a song that tells a man what to expect after prison. Explains Occam's razor. you're still a suspect after prison. That couplet says one thing that is completely unrelated to my lover doesn't believe in my sadness. She says whiskey, not time, left me wrecked after prison. Like those two couplets are in the same poem, and you could like the first one right. and hate the other one and just be like, you know what? I'm rocking with this because I like that little after prison that keeps coming up.
Right. But and that's I like that form, you know, part that we talked about last time. Yeah. I love form. I think form yeah. is super exciting and interesting. And so I feel like, I guess what I'm kind of getting at is that poetry is so vast, I guess, just like books are, I mean, or prose books are, in the sense that like you can like something for various reasons. Like someone might like that poem because of the rhyming, that person is me, the form, right? Like that keeps coming back to that after prison moment. Or someone might like it because of stanza two or stanza four or whatever.
Right.
And I think that's what's interesting and frustrating to me about poetry is like it's when you're talking about prose, it's there's only if I mean, I guess there's a multitude of things that people could like about prose too. I don't know. I don't know what my hang up is. I don't know why I struggle. I think I feel insecure about reading poetry also. And so I let that get in my way. Like, I don't get it. I'm too dumb to get this, or like something silly, which that's a me thing, obviously. And I need to like,
it's just, but I also think though, no, I think that in American poetry is cloistered. And so I do yeah. think that like, so I don't want to give poets a complete break on this. Like, frankly, a lot of poets have said, it's not my job to write something that you understand. Right. And a lot of poets have been awarded, whether it's through awards or through like getting into academic programs or through getting jobs where, look, my poetry book has a print run of 1,000, you know, my first few poetry books, right? Mm-hmm. My last book had a larger print run and a larger audience, but even that larger audience pales in comparison to, you know, what my print run will be for my nonfiction book.
Right.
And I'm talking about exponentially, even the amount of money that I got paid for one versus the other pales in comparison. And we talking about pales in comparison when neither one of them really allowed me to like live well. Right. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them allowed me to write and not work. And still I got paid exponentially more for the nonfiction than a poetry. And when I say exponentially more, I know people who buy bottles of alcohol that cost more than my advance was for my poetry book.
Wow.
And I think part of that is part and parcel with us living in a contemporary moment where the poet is not expected to communicate with all of the people. So, you know, you saying that like, you don't get it or whatever, whatever, whatever. I mean, some of it is that poets don't give a fuck if you get it.
Right.
You know, they like, yo, if you don't get it, I mean, first of all, you ain't buying enough of my books anyway for me to care if you get it. And then if you don't get it, you know what? I got a degree that costs $60,000. So if you don't get it, it's clearly your fault because my right. education means that this shit is dope.
Right.
And so I think it's some give and take because think about it. Haki Madhubuti, when he was Don L. Lee, it's like 67, between 67 and 70. He was on the cover of Jet. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a poet being on the cover of anything these days? No. Right?
Besides he their was own on the poetry book.
Right. He was on the cover of Jet, and poets won't put themselves on the cover of their own poetry books because it seems, you know, I wouldn't put myself on the cover of my own poetry book.
Nikki Giovanni did it. Nikki Giovanni did it and does it.
But she's a gangster.
But she's also but Nikki like, Giovanni, so.
Right. But he sold like 70,000 copies. I mean, wow. He sold so many poetry books back between 67 and 70, one of these books came out, that he was able to build third world books. Poets ain't selling like that. I mean, we don't even have an expectation to have an audience of 60,000 people that want to hear something that we have to say. And so I think it ain't just you. You know what I mean? I think it's also poets. And I don't know. I mean, I actually do think that it's the job of poets to think about new and radical ways to make people hear us.
Yeah. Do you think that hip hop music, because, I mean, you've mentioned it a few times, and there's clearly, you know, a connection between the writing of lyrics and poetry, right? I mean, it's poetry plus sound and music, you know, or whatever, however you want to say it. But do you think that that had something to do with the poet as potential celebrity or someone who might be on the cover of a magazine, that once we started seeing poetry put to music and these like rappers and other, I mean, I think I'm specifically talking about rappers. I shouldn't say hip hop in general, but do you think that like maybe there was like that that black people were still consuming poetry, but it was in this different package. And now the kind of written poetry is different, or no?
Nah, because I was just listening to Simon and Garfunkel. That bridge under troubled water shit.
Yeah.
Man, that shit hard as hell. You know right. what I mean? After you listen to it for the 10th time, you're like, what the fuck? You know what I mean?
Aretha
like,
Franklin's version is out of this
well,
world.
Yeah, but well, I agree with that, right? But the reason why I mentioned Simon and Garfunkel is because somebody was telling me how great a song it was. And I listened to it and I was like, the fuck is this shit?
Yeah.
And I had to listen to it 10 times before I was like, oh, this Aretha song. Yeah. You know, like I couldn't even hear the same song. And by the time I was able to recognize it, I was able to appreciate the Simon and Garfunkel version. But you could say the same thing about like Bruce Springsteen. Shit, you could say the same thing about Queen. I mean,
but that's not black culture.
Yeah, but poetics is not black culture.
No, like, I know, but I'm thinking of your example of like Jet magazine, because that is a black magazine, and I'm wondering if hip hop artists maybe took the poetry, put it to music, and took it away from more straight up poetry. I mean, I think it's cultural across the board.
Well, maybe I wasn't being fair either, because I think Hockey, he got on the cover of Jet because it was also a particular cultural moment.
I see.
And it was like the starting of black arts movement. It was the starting of, I'm sorry, black studies in universities.
It wasn't just because
of his role as a poet. Sonia Sanchez was one, I think she founded the first black studies program. So it wasn't just him as a poet, but I'm just saying that him as a poet was able to like, okay, I do shit around prison. That did not get me the cover of anything with felon.
Right.
And I think the thing that hip hop did though, and I guess that's my point, is that like the music gives you more than just the words.
Right. And it gives you a collective way to enjoy it. You know, like
right.
nobody's like, reading poetry out loud and being like, hey, I'm going to read this poem and we're all going to dance in the club. Like it's just it's a different vibe. Like you could go to a poetry reading, but it's not on that same mass level as like, let's get lit and have a fun night and have this shared thing.
And you can't even, you can't rock to no poetry and be like, I don't even care about the words. I'm just doing my homework.
Yeah.
But you put on DMX, I write poems to DMX. I'm like, you know, I'm like, nod my head, hearing the beat. And then at some point, the words just disappear. But poems, I don't know, man. It's hard, you know. But like, look, there was a world. And Marlon James talks about this in one of his interviews when he's thinking about Black Leopard, Red Wolf. You know, there was a world where all you had was words. And it was all oral. And you didn't have a book to pick up. Mm-hmm. And a job at a griot was to do multiple things. It was to give you a rhythm to dance to, and that's why you had your guitar with you. It was to give you a rhythm to dance to, but it was also to disseminate history. And you know, you think about the tradition, I think Jericho was trying to do a bunch of those things. It ain't shit to dance to in his book, but that's because poets have lost the ability to sing in such a way that asks you to dance. I mean, we might get back to it, but also our skill set has been narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. So, you know, we don't have to know how to play the guitar as a part of the accompaniment for the song that we're singing. And we don't got to have a club smash. You know what I mean? Like the hip hop artist, he got to have a club smash. So he got to be able to do two things. He got to be able to say, I'm slipping, falling, can't get up. And what these women want from, you know, like imagine a poet with that range. You know what I mean? Like the bandwidth to be able to do like the sort of deeply personal, I'm going through all of these things and yo, let's rock out in the club in three different voices. You know what I mean? Like you go to a poetry reading, sometimes I'm struggling with it. I'm like, how do I make you hear me in 17 different ways over the course of an hour? I'm afraid, you know, like sometimes I think poets are too afraid of what bandwidth we have vocally to communicate the words that we say. And so maybe part of what folks don't understand or do understand is based on their ability to hear that comes from like what we make use of.
Do you think of your poems as being something that should be read aloud when you're writing them? Or do you think of them as something to be read on the page? Because oftentimes like the form of the poem, it might look different. Some might be, you know, stanzas that have paragraph breaks in between, some might be a bunch of lines. How are you thinking about the way that a poem might sound in the world or not?
So this is the other part about form, poetry and music that gives the aids the listener in understanding, right? Because part of it is just the mnemonic of how you hear shit. And part of it is the way in which the rhyme scheme gives you access to how the poet wanted you to say it. But I think of like free verses like jazz. And so you leave little notes, but you want the reader to be able to play around within a verse and get different meanings. But as I write more and more, one of the reasons why I do consider myself a formalist is because I think writing in form and with discrete structures allows you to give the reader more guidance when they're reading a poem. Like some folks be like, I ain't gonna use punctuation. And I feel like if you're not gonna use punctuation, that shit gotta be so funky that if you put six people in a room, you could get some approximate reading that's close to each other. Mm. And I think that's a challenge. I mean, that's a challenge for poetry. It's a challenge for free verse. But again, if you write in form, then you could break out of that challenge and you could give the reader more clues of how to hear it or how to read it when they read out loud. But even within free verse, you could do its tricks, though. You could use rhetorical devices. You could use internal and external rhyme. You could use just all kinds of things, punctuation, to signal how you scan a line and get a narrow bandwidth of possibilities for the reader. And they'll get joy, you know, out of saying, yo, I actually know how this should sound. They should read it out loud, though. Mm. I mean, they should. My son is downstairs. Like, yo, I hate it, man. I gotta watch Much Ado About Nothing. And I'm like, yo, you can't be complaining about Shakespeare in this house. You know, and listening to Shakespeare, I think, is a master lesson in how actors control a line. And well, you know this because you're a theater person.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I always tell people about Shakespeare is like, you know, it's meant to be heard out loud. It was never meant to be read off the page, which is sort of where my question is rooted in. Is like, when you write poetry, do you think about it as something that will be read off the page, or do you think about it as something that's to be heard out loud?
But the thing that's funky about Shakespeare, though, is within that iambic pentameter, the actor comes to it and shows you how you could develop that line in 2, 3, 4, 5 different ways.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because within free verse, it has the same possibilities, but because it has no structure, mm-hmm. it feels like it has too many possibilities.
Yeah, it's too open.
Right, where the actor is like, you like, damn, dude was dope. He got that out of Shakespeare? Like that shit with Leonardo DiCaprio,
the Romeo
and Juliet?
But they did not abide by the iambic pentameter at all in that movie. They were like, oh, what is the iambic pentameter? We don't actually want to have that conversation. We just want to say these words out loud.
But they said, I'm saying they said the words out loud, though, in a way that still sounded like, that shit sounded Shakespearean, right? Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, it sound. So, I mean, this is like really, really inside baseball, and I'm going to sound like a real freaking nerd. But I spent a whole year doing classical theater, and we were very meticulous about using the iambic pentameter to unlock the sentence, right? Like really using the form and the structure, and like trusting that the 2 foot, like the ba da 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 da, was there to support the line, as opposed to a lot of Shakespeare actors will get the line and then be like, to be or not to be, that is the question. And you're like, well, that's not iambic pentameter, that's you, that's 3 different lines, you know. Or like, and so that was sort of what they did with that Romeo and Juliet. Like, they used the text and it sounded great and I love that movie, but when you go back and look at the actual lines, you're like, she's like, Romeo, where art thou, Romeo? I'm like, no, it's that's a line for a reason. Like, we're supposed to build, we're supposed to use the line. You know what I mean? Yeah. Anyways, again, obsessed with form, love a form, but like a bad reading of a poem destroys the poem. Like, if someone said, name a song that tells a man what to expect after prison, explains Occam Razor. You're still a suspect after prison. You'd be like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, that's one. Those are 2 lines for a reason. Like, they should have the same flow. Like, so, you know, you've given us a guidepost, I guess, is what I'm saying. And like, do you think about that in the way that you that
when people listen to this, you got to know if I ever hear somebody in public read my shit like that, you know, when somebody snatched the microphone, they'd be like, if they start doing poetry or karaoke. and you see me tackle somebody, that's because the karaoke person did that to my poem.
Right. Well, but people do that. People love to like add these pauses, especially in Shakespeare. They love to be like, let me act in between all these words. It's like, no, motherfucker, it's iambic pentameter. Like, ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. You know, that's it. That's what he wrote. Like, that's the whole point. There's, anyways, again, I told you this was going to be me getting nerdy about Shakespeare.
But this is the challenge of poetry, because I think the challenge of poetry gives people too many opportunities to think between the words.
Yes.
And so sometimes there's so many opportunities to do that that they have a hard time hearing what's actually being said. And sometimes when they hear it, because they aren't trained to think of it in a certain way, like somebody sent me one of my guzzles, a new one that I wrote, and they transcribed it. And this is my man. He's brilliant, right? He sent me some shit, man. And I was like, the fuck is this? Who wrote this poem?
Right, literally.
Like, you know, he took like four couplets and it became a 26 line free verse poem.
Right.
And I was like, I know I didn't sound like that, because he was transcribing from listening to me.
Huh.
And I'm like, I know I didn't sound like that, because the guzzle is intentionally instopped at the end of each line. So right. It's like, da-dun, 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 boom. Da-dun, 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 boom. Right. And then you hit a rep. It's like, yo, you couldn't have heard that. But again, I think, and this cat, you know, he's like an artist, right? This is my man. I know that if I went up into a painting and I was trying to say something that happened in the painting, he'd be like, nah, you ain't got to take it there, bro, because that ain't even the right color. That's right. Cerulean.
Right.
And you said blue?
Yeah.
No, that is cerulean. You know what I mean? He might say something like that to me. So I think, but I think poetry gives you the inside baseball to enjoy. But it also gives you, like Jericho says in the last line of the tradition, John Crawford, Eric Garner, Mike Brown, which everybody gets. And those three names change and shift the entire poem in a way
mm-hmm.
that I think automatically you begin to know what, and literally what happens before that does not mean the same thing as what it means once you hear those three names.
Right. Okay, wait, let's take a really quick break because I want to talk like more specifically about some of the poems in the book. Today's episode is sponsored by Care Of. Care Of is a wellness brand that makes it easy to maintain your health goals with a customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long term. Care Of is super user-friendly and customizable. When you start, you do their online quiz to figure out what vitamins are right for your health needs. They ask you about your activity level, your sleep, your levels of stress, your hair growth, your skin, and they put together a plan that's just for you. When it comes to your house, it's wrapped in individual packaging so your cabinets aren't packed with a bunch of bottles of stuff that you don't even know what it is. It has a little guide that explains everything, so it's super easy to understand what it is you're taking. They also make it easy for you to stick to a vitamin routine because each month the vitamins come right to your doorstep. And if you're making any changes in your lifestyle, you can make changes to your Care Of supplement routine whenever you want. If you want to check out Care Of and get 50% off your first order, head to takecareof.com and use the code STAX50. Again, that's takecareof.com with the code STAX50 for 50% off your first order. First of all, one of my questions about this collection, and I don't know if you can answer this. I'm going to ask you a question about author intent. So, you know, I understand that you're not him and you don't know, but the book is broken. Okay, great. The book is broken into three sections. What do you think that breaking a poetry collection into sections does when there's no title? We're just like 1, 2, 3. Was there something that you gathered that part one was about or part two? Or do you just sort of read it and just say, okay.
Yeah, I ain't gonna front. I read it and say, okay.
Okay, me too. Great.
Because the truth is, like, after you read it 10 times, then you might have a real sense of the movement between sections. But honestly, man, a poetry book is 30, 40 poems.
Right.
A fucking hip hop album is 13 songs nowadays. Now they want to do 8 joints, right?
Right, right, right.
So it's like the ability for us to cohesively understand 40 discrete different pieces of information that are all packed with 1,000 things.
Right.
You know, I even with my own books, I don't just like, nah, fuck that shit. You know what I mean?
I feel like I order it
in a certain way, but.
Yeah. I feel like the third section was clearly about sexuality and about like his sexuality as art. So not necessarily his specifically, but like kind of exploring that section. But the first two sections, I really had a hard time figuring out the difference. And also the third section was about other things too, but that's sort of what I, like the third section felt the most personal, intimate. like sexuality, relationships, love. And I feel like the earlier sections felt broader. Like it felt like this book started broad and kind of like went more and more narrow. So by the end, it was like felt very, that's where it felt the most like Jericho's voice, if you will.
Oh, so I wouldn't agree with the last point, but I would agree with the first one. Like you do feel a narrowing in.
Yeah.
But you kind of feel a narrowing in from the sort of public private intersection
right.
to the private private.
Right.
And, you know, and one might conclude that the private private is somehow related to, I don't conclude that it's related to Jericho's life because I refuse to believe that a poet is, even when they're talking about their life.
Yeah.
Because niggas lie.
Yeah.
You know, niggas lie.
Right.
And also you have an agenda based on art, based on who you want to be in the world, based on who you are in the world. I'm just saying, if somebody thinks that I am my poems, they have made a mistake.
Right.
Even when I am my poems.
Right.
Because, you know,
right.
it's just like, but in here, though, you do see a clear, like you said, it's like this narrowing to like the private private. And what's kind of cool about that is that like, Black people don't get to have a private private in America.
Right.
You know, people tell you, like, how'd you feel about last week? What do you mean how I felt about last week? Because, you know, last week was real.
For people, well, this will air in 2 weeks. So last week, we're talking about the week of Dante Wright. We're talking about the week of...
No. America's so fucked up. America's so fucked up that last week could literally be...
It could be any last week.
Whatever last week.
Sure. Yeah. But are you speaking specifically about this most recent last week or no?
Yeah,
I just don't want people to like listen because people are going to listen to this like in 2 months and then they're going to be like, what the fuck was last week? And they're going to be like, it could be any last week.
They could be like, how did he know that I ain't paying my rent?
Yeah.
Because it was what, but no, I am talking about Chauvin.
Yeah.
And
Adam.
And it's just names.
Yeah. I mean,
Toledo.
Yeah. Adam Toledo. It's just, it's been. And you're right. I shouldn't say that it was more Jericho's life at the end. I think what I mean more is like, it was the writer's intimate life. So not the character of Jericho as we see him. It felt like that, like you're saying, the first part maybe was like public, then public private, and then private or something like that. I don't know.
No, it's real. Yeah. And I think it's important to note that. I keep trying to educate people and I might be wrong. Other poets will get on and be like, no, that was exactly me.
Right.
I don't know what Dwayne is talking about. You know, Dwayne got some demons he's trying to hide. He likes to lie about who he is. But no, I keep trying to educate people about the notion that the I contains multitudes and the I is multitudes.
Right.
It's like a sin eater. The poet is a sin eater.
Right.
I take all of that shit, you know.
I think that's true for most artists and most people who create things. Like one of the things that I struggle with this podcast a lot is that people think that they know me from these conversations. And like, yes, you do know about me and I don't lie when I come on this podcast and I'm not like, I'm not telling you something and then that's not true. But also like, it's such a small part. This is such a small part of who I am and where I come from and all of those things. And I think that that's true for a lot. I mean, we hear about people, you know, going up to celebrities in public and because they think that they know them from, you know, following them on Instagram or something. And that there's this
right
familiarity because you're familiar with someone's art is not the same as actually being familiar with someone. Like
before we talk about Jericho poem, let me tell you what somebody said to me. He says, I dug your poems, but you know, I don't drink. And so I really couldn't relate to the references to alcohol in your poems. There's a dude in prison. And I thought a dude in prison would be the last person that's telling me that he couldn't empathize with my shit because he doesn't drink. And it was wild because I was like, oh, what kind of problems do you think I got? Because I work 70 hours a week. I got 2 children. I've been married for 13 years. And I drink. But I'm all
right. Right.
You know, I ain't got no DUIs.
Right.
I ain't got a bunch of empty bottles around the house. My kids ain't never seen me drunk, but like once or twice. Like, you know, like my friends don't be like, Dwayne, you got a problem. I don't have a problem. Or like, I don't have more of a problem than
anyone else.
Yeah. Right. And my poems and like he's reading poems. It's like it's a poem that says, prison killed you, my love, killed you so dead. You're not here now. You're never here. You're always there. Brown liquor owns you. Those cells own you. And there's no room for me unless I call the police, call the state, grab my pistol and set you free. Hmm. This cat read that and thought somebody said that to me.
Right. Right.
And I'm like, bruh, you don't know me, right. You know? And like, you should be able to empathize with that thing that I said, because I empathize with it.
Right.
And ain't nobody say that to me. You know, right. that world doesn't exist. And I think that's why I pushed back against the speaker as poet. Because what happens is we want to be better than the poet. And I'm like, bro, you ain't got to be better than me. You ain't got to read my poem to be better than me. I'm all right. And it's, you know, and it's like, we ain't got to do that. But it's two versions of poet as speaker. Because a little kid hit me up and I was doing a thing. He was like, yo, man, I was reading your poems. You got a lot of references to drinking. I just want to know, you all right? Now, he, some 15-year-old kid in the juvenile detention center, asking me with a Yale law degree and like a family and doing pretty well. And I'm visiting him, right?
Right.
Him asking me, all right, was like both cute and human. Mm. He wasn't trying to be better than me. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was trying to be thoughtful and caring and empathizing. And I think that's the tension that we confront when we try to associate the poem with the poet. Mm. And most of us don't have the human capacity to be that 15-year-old kid. And therefore, we should stop associating the poem with the poet, because when we do it, we only do it to sort of judge.
Right. Do you have any favorite poems that stuck out to you from this collection, or anything that you like really worked for you?
I mean, given the week, Bullet Points and The Tradition. And The Tradition is funky as hell, because The Tradition is saying, one, I am a poet. And two, I care about shit that you might not predict me caring about, or you might not predict me put front facing it. So, you know, The Tradition, I'm a read it if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
The Tradition. Aster, Nasturtium, Delphinium. We thought fingers and dirt meant it was our dirt. Learning names and heat and elements classical philosophers said could change us. Stargazer. Foxglove. Summer seemed to bloom against the will of the sun, which news report claimed flame hotter on this planet than when our dead fathers wiped sweat from their necks. Cosmos, baby's breath. Men like me and my brothers filmed that we planted for proof we existed before too late. Spared the video to see blossoms brought in seconds, colors you expect in poems where the world ends. Everything cut down. John Crawford, Eric Garner, Mike Brown. Oh, that's a good ass poem.
Can I confess something?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is one of the poems I did not really get.
Oh!
And I did read this one multiple times because it's the title of the collection. I was confused. Like, I got confused. I do understand bullet points. It's very straightforward to me. But, like,
I'm glad that you don't get this one.
I don't get it.
Because, like, look, off the top, Aster, Nasturtium, Delphinium. Don't nobody give a fuck about that shit. None of us know what that means. But then he says, we thought fingers in dirt meant it was our dirt. We all understand that. You think because you planting something in that grass that you could name that the ground belongs to you, right? Stargazer, Foxglove. And note how he goes from the sort of Latinate names to like Stargazer, Foxglove, which is the funky name for flowers, right? And we know he's talking about flowers, so he's talking about beauty. Black folks and niggas, black men, niggas could be white men too, but I don't really give a fuck about them niggas. But like, not in this conversation, but black men don't get to get associated with loam, with putting their hands in dirt and growing something, right? Summer seemed to bloom against the will of the sun. Now you realize that that's going to come back at the end. We seem to bloom against the will of what might destroy us, right? And it's like, on this planet, then when our dead fathers wipe sweat from their necks. This whole history, right? It's like this poet, the speaker, is trying to remember that it's not just me planting flowers. It's me planting flowers in a world where my father planted cotton. All flowers, but this history. And one might argue that like I think Jericho is obsessed with fathers. I am too. But I think he's obsessed with fathers throughout his work in a way that a lot of men aren't as obsessed with their mothers, because our mothers ain't hurt us as much. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then it speeds up and it says, men like me and my brothers film what we planted for proof we existed before too late. Spared the video to see blossoms brought in seconds. Colors you expect in poems where the world ends. Everything cut down. Like, how do you make evidence? I brought my son a plant today, I should say. Like a pepperoncino or some shit like that. And I brought him a plant that survives well in low light. And that doesn't need to be watered except once every 2 months. Because I want Makai to, like, nurture something.
Mm-hmm.
And know that it's his to nurture. And I think that the travesty of this poem is that it articulates a bunch of boys or men of ages that we don't know, both trying to nurture some shit and then record it because they're afraid of how tenuous their ability to do that is.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to make a record of it. And then it ends. And notice it ends on a rhyme. The last couplet rhymes. Where the world ends, everything cut down. John Crawford, Eric Garner, Mike Brown. And so everything that precedes it becomes a way that black boys are trying to say, I exist in this world. The poem is trying to argue that black boys do more than kill.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it still ends on everything being cut down. And this list of black men who you know were cut down by the police in ways they didn't deserve. Now, you know, I like that poem, but I'll agree with you that it takes more massaging to get. And maybe I get it in a different way because I'm taking pictures of plants trying to find out. I mean, I got shit growing in my yard that I didn't plant. And that I'm like, damn, this is amazing.
Hmm.
And people are telling me, oh, it's going to happen every year. The bulbs are in the dirt.
Right.
Even if you cut this down right now, it's coming back.
Right.
You know, and it's attention in that poem because all of those fancy ass flowers coming back, but Mike Brown ain't, you know?
Right.
It's this tension in how our country, on occasion, far too frequently, even if it's just infrequent, cuts us down in a way that we can't return from. So.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
I still don't understand that shit.
No, I mean, I definitely feel like I'm on an intellectual level enough that if someone explains something to me, I can follow them. So like definitely what you said makes sense. But when I read this poem, and again, I read it a few times because I was like, this is the title poem. I should probably get this one. I really was like, I don't get it. What happens to me when I feel like I don't get it is I just start to like glaze over and I like stop paying attention a little bit, you know, like, I don't know, probably from school when teachers were telling you stuff and you're like, I don't get this. I want to go.
That was a hard poem though. And it's much harder than bullet points.
I think bullet points is like pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And I think I mean that's sort of what I feel like I need, like the young readers version of this collection where it's like the poems that are straightforward for you to start with, and like then we'll add on more complex things. But like some of like earlier we were talking about poems that maybe like have something that makes you like them even if you don't get the whole thing. And for me, like Shovel, I really liked because there was a lot of consonant use throughout the poem and it like did something to me. I think it was maybe like kind of brought some humor into it or like a sense of play that hadn't been in, I guess I hadn't noticed it earlier, but like that's something that like, I don't even remember what the poem was about, but I remember being like, oh, I like this poem because it's like really playing with consonants.
Yeah, and I think this is straightforward too, though.
It probably is, because I liked it.
But the sounds is what makes it a poem. I mean, the sounds is what carries it,
right?
And the sounds is what like slips you into the meaning. That is a kind of darkness in it, you know, because it's like who's responsible for, you know, it says I am not the man who put a bullet in its brain, but I am commissioned to dispose of the corpse. Lay furniture plastic next to it and roll it over until it is wrapped. Tape with duct tape until it is completely detained. Lay next to that containment atop and roll it over until it is wrapped again. Take cheap hard wire twine and tie it like a proper gift. A gift a good child will give up on opening even come Christmas morning. I am here to ignore the stench and throw the dead over my left shoulder and carry it to the bed of a stolen truck. I did not steal the truck, but there it is. Outside the door, engine running, I do the driving and assume someone else must scrub the floor of the body's blood. Scrub the body's last room of its evidence. I do the driving and sing whatever love songs the truck's radio affords me all the way to the edge of anywhere hiking families refuse to wander. And I dig and dig and dig as undertakers did before the advent of machinery. And look, I know somebody who had their folks murdered by a motherfucker who dumped their body over a ravine hoping that nobody would find that shit. And somebody found it finally because of Kamala Harris. Because the person had worked with her sister and Kamala Harris, and when this woman's sister disappeared and they knew somebody murdered her and the police wasn't doing shit. And I read this poem and I think, is it beauty in this poem about this nigga that is burying the body so the killer go free? And I think that's what the poem is asking me. It's like, ultimately, when we think about crime and punishment, what fucking excuses can somebody make for the decisions that they make? The speaker keeps saying, I am not the man who put a bullet in its brain. Its brain.
Right.
Not this woman's brain, not this man's brain, not this child's brain.
Right.
You commissioned to dispose of the corpse? Like, we had a conversation about abolition and accountability.
Mm-hmm.
What accountability does this person deserve?
Right.
Who in its very rhetoric cannot even identify the human who has been wrecked by what happened before he came.
Do you know what's so interesting though about this one for me is like, I totally played into that and felt like this was a character and like that this was supposed to be some sort of comic relief. That's how I read this poem. Like that this poem was sort of like a moment of like, I mean, obviously you could read it your way, which is makes more sense, but for whatever reason, the way that the consonants like had that pattern, like in the beginning it's like lots of T's and C's, and then in the middle it's lots of B, D's and S's, and like that there's this like, and like pss, 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 pss. Like I heard that and it made me think that this poem was I read it as like a character. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, but what's interesting is I ain't feel this way about this poem until I just read it.
Huh.
And that might be like my third time reading it.
Right.
And I was so mad that I couldn't finish reading it.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like, I didn't intend to say what I said about the poem.
Right.
The poem reveals something else to me on the third reading. The poem, I mean, you know, like the poem raises questions that I deal with in my work all the time.
Right.
You know, how do you respond? You know what I mean? Like, how do you respond to this character?
Right.
Who is like my cousin.
Right.
And is my cousin trying to say, and this is a poem that ain't got no white people in it.
Right.
Or this is a poem that ain't got no black people in it.
Right.
Like, this is a poem when you read it as the speaker, it is only the people you imagine to be in it.
Right.
And so now when I do this thing, when I am this person, the poem is fucked up too, because it makes you the person.
Right.
Because when you say it out loud, you know, you the person that's doing these things, right? And it's like, damn, how should the world respond to me when this is who I am? This is the people that carried Mike Brown, Eric Garner. This is the dude that carried them away.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah.
He was that's the cat that was commissioned to do the same thing.
Right.
And it wasn't illegal. It wasn't illegal. You know what I mean? Like in my head, I was like, I am not the man who put a bullet in his brain, but I am commissioned to dispose of the corpse. Yeah. Lay furniture plastic next to it and roll it over until it is wrapped. That's what they did to Mike Brown.
Right. Yeah.
It was somebody commissioned to do it. And it's the only thing that this is illicit because it's like my left shoulder carried to the bed of a stolen truck.
Right.
But you know, but until you get to that point, it could be any
right
person that's disposing of a body murdered by the cops.
I think that's also what makes poetry different for me from reading, you know, nonfiction or even a fiction novel, is that that we are asked to bring more of our interpretation to the text than we are when it's a story or like when it's a linear type thing. Because you presented two options for this poem and my reading of it was totally different. And I feel like all of the readings, you know, are valid or whatever. And I'm sure other people read this in a different way. And I'm sure some people are like, I didn't get this one. And some people are like, you guys are idiots. It's about this, actually, which I'm sure my listeners will tell me later. They'll be like, you're an idiot. Here's what these poems are about.
We'll see. I'm like only arrogant about interpreting poems. But it's cool, though. Poems can mean two or three different things, which is ultimately the beauty of them.
Right.
And maybe the tragedy of them as well.
Right. I do want to ask you about the duplex poems because they kind of repeat throughout the collection. What did you think of those? Because I didn't understand what they were doing in the collection.
I think it's the form. It's a form that he invented. But I'm a cop to liking the poems, but having very little interest in understanding the form.
Okay. That's fair.
You know, it's just like, I was just like, maybe I'll understand it five readings from now. But right. I sort of just felt like, you know, it's a thing that contemporary poets do where they invent form. And this one is like going down and up. It's kind of echoing each other. But the way in which it echoes, it varies to such a degree that it's not like a complete echo. So you just have to think about it a lot more to get something from it, and I'm good.
Okay.
I ain't even gonna front. I like the poems,
right?
But in terms of trying to understand the form and write about the form and talk about the form, it just doesn't have that. You don't be bad, but dude, Dwayne and Sponge, you say this, but I'm saying like I like a sonnet. You know what I mean? I like 14 lines. I like iambic pentameter.
Yeah,
I like the guzzle.
I love a sonnet.
You know, and it's just like so for this one, I mean, I like the invention,
right?
But I don't imagine that I would want to write one. And I didn't want to spend the time to understand what the form was.
Right.
And I still kind of don't. So.
Yeah, I wish that I understood those better in relationship to each other and to the collection. But again, I struggled there. I do want to just give a quick shout out. Jericho Brown was on the On Being podcast, which I listened to, and it was very interesting. You reminded me of it because you said that he's interested in his father, and he talks a lot about when he says father, like what he means, and that he is interested in that there's like a relationship to God and to his own father and like multiple layers of what father is. And he talks about it a bunch on that episode.
I fuck with Jericho. I don't know if I like that episode of On Being, but
you don't.
But again,
I just felt like it gave me more background into him. I don't know that I.
Exactly.
That's why you don't like it.
No, well, I like it. I like it for that. But somebody told me once that this is a great podcast to listen to understand poetry, and I was like, nah, that was great to understand Jericho.
Right. I did not feel like I understood poetry anymore.
Yeah, and he's fascinating, and so I think it was cool because you learn things in terms of insight, in terms of like what he was getting at and how he's writing.
That's what I liked about it. I mean, one of the things that I also struggle with poetry is like, how important is the author's intent to the reading of it? Like, how important is it that you know who Eric Brown, or we keep saying Eric Brown, Eric Garner is, or Mike Brown? How important is that? Because right now we all know, but in 20 years, maybe, you know, like my kids in 20 years might not know who that is. I mean, hopefully they will because I'll have done a good job. But you know what I mean? Like, how important is the inciting event or the biography or the history or the background of the poet? Like,
it can't be. It can't be, because if it is, and I want to read one more poem by Jericho. Okay. It's not in his book. But this is actually arrogant and narcissistic of me. But I want to say that I think that Jericho don't matter and that I don't matter. And I wrote a poem after Jericho in Felon. And it's after Jericho. Don't nobody know it's after Jericho because, you know, like they don't know that I know him. But ultimately, like, if the poem matters, it doesn't matter because you know that me and him are friends. It doesn't matter that you know that it matters because of the poem. All of the backstory. You don't even know because it's called City of the Moon and it's for JB.
Mm.
So I didn't even put his whole name in. There walks a man somewhere wanting the touch of another man. And somewhere people know that desire. Name the walking man after you, Jericho. Because God once promised to bring the city to his knees for the man circling you with his trumpet. Going down from Jerusalem, a man broke another man. They say those men lost and gospel and what God can't fathom. Odalisk and outstretched arm. They don't know every love is a kind of robbery. And sometimes hurt is a kind of mending. A body only broken by death. Every moan ain't a cry. This is always about vulnerability. How others afraid to touch a man who touches a man have need to imagine hips and the flesh they flank as a confession. The body threatens. Call that fear suffering. The heathen is always afraid of a warm body against his own. And while some say things always return to a man and his desire to be touched and touch, that want to be known governs us all. And you know, like if that shit matters 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 20 years from now, it is not going to be because of some graduate student who recognizes that JB is Jericho Brown.
Mm.
And it's not going to be because they read some shit into our relationship that is completely non-existent, mm-hmm. right? It's not going to be because they read something about me trying to grapple with everything I'm trying to grapple with in a poem that they can't have a clue on. Except they're going to cite the Stacks and be like, well, in this Stacks interview, he was talking about...
Oh my gosh, you know, I can't wait to be a cited source. That's my dream.
Oh, well, shit, we should cite ourselves then. You know, because that's what Columbus did. Columbus was like, I found the new world, and he cited himself into people believing.
Okay, we're running out of time. I only have one more question for you, which is...
I'm going to read the first couplet then.
Read a little bit from the Jericho Brown poem, not in the book.
From Hustle, just because you don't like it's self-referencing.
Okay.
They lie like stones and dare not shift. Even asleep, everyone hears in prison. Dwayne Betts deserves more than this dry ink for his teenage years in prison. In the film we keep watching, Nina takes Darius to a stepper's bar. Lovers hustle, slide, and dip as if none of them has a brother in prison. I eat with humans who think any book full of black characters is about race. A book full of white characters examines insanity, but never in prison. His whole family made a barricade of their bodies at the door to room 403. He died without the man he wanted. What use is love at home or in prison? We saw police pull sharks out of the water just to watch them not breathe. A brother meets members of his family as he passes the mirrors in prison. Sundays, I washed and dried her clothes after he threw them into the yard. In a novel I love, Brownfield kills his wife, gets only 7 years in prison. I don't want to point my own sinful finger, so let's use your clean one instead. Some bright citizen reading this never considered a son short hair in prison. In our house lived three men with one name, and all three fought or ran. I left Nelson Demery III for Jericho Brown, a name I earned in prison. It's crazy. I want to say one more thing in there before you answer your question, okay. Right?
Go ahead.
Actually, like reading that poem again, which I hadn't read in years, I realize how many layers it is to it. And it again, echoes this thing about the father and how we think about our fathers. And maybe one of the reasons why I fuck with his poetry is because me and my dad got the same name and I didn't give my son my name. Mm. And the other thing is that it's layered. The guzzle allows you to talk about so many different things at once.
Mm. Okay, so this is how we always sort of end these episodes, which is just to talk briefly about the title and the cover of the book, like the packaging itself. Obviously, we spent a lot of time talking about the poem, the tradition, but I think that also I'm going to start since I already started talking. I think like what I like about, I mean, this cover is gorgeous. I think this is one of my most favorite covers I've ever seen. I love the flowers and the flower crown. And I think that those things obviously come up a lot in the book. And I love, of course, the black child. And I like that there's a call to like perhaps some sort of slave clothes is like what that shirt reminds me of, but also maybe prison clothes. Like I feel like the cover is very ambiguous, and then of course the ocean, and I just feel like it covers so much of American traditions, right? Like the slave trade. I just feel like I see so many options there, but also maybe this is in Africa before. Like I just the cover feels like a poem in the sense that I have no idea if I'm right or wrong, but I'm thinking a lot of different thoughts about it and its relationship to what's inside, which I think is very cool. And then also it's just really beautiful. So that's what I'll say about those things.
You know, what's wild is, you know, those are daisies, those are tulips. Like, I have all of those, the flowers in my garden. And I live in this house that we bought from this cat that was 85. And he was cool as shit. I mean, he made a beautiful bookshelf. And this is basically the reason why I wanted to buy the house. It's made of bricks and cinder blocks and like planks. And it's beautiful, right? And so his wife loved tulips. Mm. And they was like really deep in the garden. And they lived here for 30 years. And again, we moved in before we could see those things. And so now this spring, we're seeing all these flowers that we didn't know would come up. Mm. And they'll come up every year again. You know, it's right. Sort of like the regeneration or whatever. So I think that the cover is beautiful, right? Because what it's saying is, if you know about flowers, you know that these, what you see, the beauty you see is fleeting.
Right.
And you might imagine a time period between like, you know, June and April as a suffering. Or you might imagine it as a regeneration. And Black folks in America have had to deal with those kind of time periods for quite, you know, all the time. Hmm. It's our experience. And the question is, do we think about the tradition as one of suffering or one as regeneration? And like, ultimately, I think what the book is trying to say is that it's one of regeneration. And I think the ability to speak about the suffering is like the mechanism that gets us toward regeneration.
Right.
It's always hard to talk about a book. I mean, we could have spent like 2 hours you know, talking about every poem.
Right.
But I think at the end of the day, the poems say something about what it means to become.
Sure.
And the cover captures like that becoming.
Right. I also think it could be about suffering and regeneration, and that for many of us, those things are linked deeply, you know, they're of the same flower, right? Like, it's like the flower and then the pollen that gets all over you. If you have like a lily, you know, you got to cut that part out.
and I don't have any allergies. My wife got allergies, right? And it's wild because it's like our relationship to nature is completely different. Mm-hmm. And for her, the suffering and the beauty is completely intertwined because she loves flowers, but you know, allergies and shit.
Yeah. I mean, I think what makes this collection really good is that it is complicated, and I feel like there is lots to revisit and lots to unpack, and like just with the title and the cover, there's so much there. Like, what tradition for who? Whose tradition? Where? When? What? You know? And I think like that's the mark of a good anything, is like it's worth discussing, it's worth being confused over and like not getting it necessarily.
Well, even in that poem, because you could argue that the tradition is like this country murdering Black men, or you could argue that the tradition is Black men growing things.
I was gonna say, because you said, you know, we don't think of Black people, like we don't think of Black men growing things, and I think that's interesting because now we don't, but 100 years ago, it's like all people thought about Black men is that they were good for growing shit. Like, you know, right. Like, and so I think that's also interesting, is like the way that the tradition shifts through time, and sort of kind of what I was asking about, like needing to know the inciting incident, or like needing to know the history or the biography, is like, is that important? We've gone so over today, which whatever, fine.
This podcast is a treasure though. I got to tell you, I think one of the things is like just to care about literature and spend time with each other. Caring about literature is one of the things that like sustains the culture and the community. And I am really grateful for you doing this, because poems are hard.
Yeah.
But you know what? As hard as poems are, we just like talked about them for like a long time. And we talked about everything that fills the space around them. And I think when we recognize that that's what poems are for, poems stop being hard and they start being the beginning.
Right.
You know, and like, yes, we could go back to Jericho's book again and again.
Right. Just because something's hard doesn't mean that it's not, you know, worthwhile. It just means that it takes a little bit more. I'm so glad that you were here. We didn't even talk about the Million Book Project. I will do it in the intro, of course, but just a reminder to folks, we are raising $50,000 for the Million Book Project, which is the nonprofit that Dwayne started, and it brings books into prisons, new books, books that are beautiful and have beautiful things to say. And we're raising $50,000 to do that. And if you can contribute in any way, and if you've already contributed and you can find, maybe you got paid since the last time you contributed, you can find another $10 or $20. That would be amazing and huge. And you have until May 6th to make that donation. And we'd appreciate
it. And I should say, I mentioned a couple people who responded to my book, and it's folks who responded to other books that we've been sending in to them. And what's cool though, is that they are responding to the books, and they are starting to start a conversation about what a book means. And even if I don't necessarily agree with how they read my book, like I'm gonna write one woman because she was like, I opened this and I was like, oh, another Black Lives Matter treatise. And I was like, yo, you know what? I'm gonna write you a letter. Cause first you opened my book, but you didn't read it. But I'm gonna write you a letter because this book has begun. It's become the start of a conversation that might like actually matter. And so when folks are donating, I think that we are just saying the reason why books matter is because they allow us to have conversations that sometimes our imagination before opening the page of that book doesn't prepare us for. Even if we're wrong, I'm gonna write homie back too.
Because
what I want to say to him is, you know, you can't be in prison wanting people to empathize with you and suggest that you can't understand an experience you haven't experienced.
Right.
And so I appreciate everybody who donates.
Yes.
I think it's like it's become my life's work. And it started when I was 16. So it's kind of cool that the same thing that mattered then matters now.
Yeah. I love that. Dwayne, thank you so much for being here. And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening. And thank you again to Dwayne for being my guest. Please consider making a donation to the Million Book Project through the link in the show notes. Help us hit our goal of $50,000 towards getting books into prisons nationwide. Our May book club pick is Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy, and we will discuss the book on Wednesday, May 26th. Tune in next week to find out who our guest will be. Go to takecareof.com and use the code STAX50 to get 50% off your first order. Please make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, visit us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer, and our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. Our theme music is from Tegeerages. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
Seven years ago, college wrestler Damien Hurd disappeared from a party in Gunnison, Colorado.
Everyone has been drinking or whatever, the usual party scene.
When, how, and why he left are questions I need your help to understand.
Nobody's heard from him.
No, it's just like he disappeared.
From Cold Case Productions and Podcast One, Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Hurd. I'm your host, Claire Sanima. Join me April 20th for the season premiere.